Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, October 10, 2013. And here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. We'll, of course, be talking about the government shutdown because it continues to be the number one issue that everybody talks about, although they don't talk about the right stuff, but that's why we talk about it. We'll also take a look at the new Fed chairman and see why the new chairman is pretty much the old chairman in drag. We're also going to take a quick look at the latest on the NSA and Obamacare. But if we can get to it, we'll also get to what's going on in Syria because we haven't touched on that in a while. But we're going to start off with the shutdown itself and the various impacts it has. And toward that end, we have a special guest with us today, actually an old friend returning to join us. Bill G., former co-host here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, is joining us today with a very interesting perspective on how the shutdown is affecting the poor and people who try to administer the poor. So, Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Walt. Great to be back.
Glad to have you here. So I know we have limitations in terms of what we can say. What we will say is that Bill works for a 501c nonprofit that administers federally funded programs for the poor, and that's about all we can say about it. But as a result of that, he has been experiencing both in his own work and in the work that his organization does, some of the direct impact that the shutdown has had, particularly on poor people. So, Bill, I'm just going to give you a couple minutes here. Give us an overview of what's been going on there.
Well, like you said, I work for a nonprofit organization, and our primary function is to administer federal funds to help administer to the poor. And basically what's been going on here is ever since the last Monday, we just don't know where our next meal's coming from. Literally, in the agency, our contacts in D.C. are on furlough. We have had trouble getting access to our bank accounts, and as a result, many of the programs that we are offering to help alleviate poverty in the area that I'm living in now have been basically on hold. We've been able to administer some of our programs, and thankfully we've been also blessed with an influx of private dollars coming in to help us get by. But if this shutdown continues, we are probably not going to be able to make our next payroll, and so that means we're going to have to be furloughed just like the rest of the people over in the federal government.
Now, give us an idea of what kinds of programs are we talking about. I know you have limitations in terms of what you can talk about, but just give us an idea of what these programs do.
Well, we administer the National Head Start program, and we serve roughly 3,000 children in the greater Lexington area that I live in, and we also administer to. We also do weatherization programs for people who are below poverty. People live in homes that need new furnaces, new water heaters. We go in there and replace those for free with the help of the utility company, the Kentucky Utility, and Columbia Gas also pitches in to help out with that. Our federal dollars are mostly to administer our Head Start funds, but it's also used to just cover basic, just keeping the lights on in the various neighborhood centers that we administer.
Now, of course, some of the news that has come out this past week includes news that federal workers are going to get paid their vacation time after this whole thing settles down. I imagine that when you hear and read stuff like that, you kind of must be shaking your head, wondering what the priorities are. I mean, things like making sure that there's plenty of military coverage in around the world and that kind of thing. None of that actually is getting shut down at all. But I imagine it kind of rubs the wrong way. Am I reading it wrong?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's very frustrating, especially when you read that a lot of the state programs that also administer the poor, such as food banks and that sort of thing, are going to be laying off thousands and thousands of workers. I mean, these are state workers. I think I read in Michigan that something like 200,000 state workers are going to lose their on furlough or be laid off because the programs that they administer depend so heavily on federal funds that just aren't coming. So yeah, it definitely rubs us the wrong way that it seems like really messed up priorities here, because when you think about it, administering to the poor is a national security issue, and yes, we got all these military actions and their military is up and running, which is great, but if we ignore the poor, they're going to get mad. When people don't get enough food, when people don't get enough, their kids can't go to daycare because they don't, because the daycare center is closed. That means they have to quit their jobs or find some other ways of taking care of their kids, and they're not earning a living anymore, and so they have to depend even more heavily on the state, or they consider committing crime or something like that, and then they become incarcerated, and that ends up costing the taxpayers even more.
Bill, I lean libertarian, and Bill Westmiller does too, and libertarians often take the position against state involvement in solving poverty problems and so forth. But I want to put in 2 cents about that because of this particular issue that we brought up here. And my 2 cents ties in to my favorite issue, the monetary system, because what we have here with this budget crisis is not only a crisis in crazy spending priorities, but it's also a crisis that is driven by monetary expansion, as it has been for decades now. And what's happening is it's finally coming to a peak, as you and I, Bill G, have talked about in the past. So what we end up with here is a system that essentially, through monetary expansion, draws value from the poorest and middle-class sections of society in order to allow the wealthiest sections of society to invest it at extremely low rates for their own profit and in essence call all that prosperity, when in fact it provides just the opposite. And then the net result, of course, is that when the span hits the fan, we get millions of people who end up suffering from that kind of a crazy economic system that we have with this crazy expansionary monetary system. And so that's where we end up with the government programs that come in to try to alleviate the problems that have been solved. So again, my 2 cents is, while I'm not really crazy about these programs, getting rid of them is my last priority. My first priority is getting rid of the thing that caused the mess in the first place, because once we do that, we get rid of the need to even have them, because then you don't have people who are trying to struggle to just keep, you know, the roof over the house and heat coming in and clothes on their back and so forth. So I just wanted to throw that in. Bill Westmiller, you might want to throw in something of your own, but I just wanted to put my own 2 cents in on that.
Well, I want to congratulate Bill G for being on a career track to becoming president. Started as a community organizer, then the state assembly and Senate, and you could be running for president in about 6 years.
Oh, joy. I think my wife would have a problem with that.
No, I wanted to clarify. So I'm a libertarian, so I'm opposed to all these various supposedly charitable government programs. But it's very true that once the government becomes involved, people depend upon it. They become dependent on the program funding, and when it's reduced or cut out, people suffer. And there's no doubt about that. And we can certainly commiserate with all the people that are dependent on government funding. But programs like Head Start strike me as totally superfluous. All the studies have been done shows that it has no beneficial effect whatsoever for the kids involved. It's basically a babysitting service.
That's
what I read. Okay.
Okay. Well, there's also been a lot of other studies that show that. I mean, granted that a child in when a 2-year-old is in a daycare/Head Start program, they are not receiving the nurturing and education that you would get from a stay-at-home parent who could be with that child all the time, who could, because, you know, my own son is a stay-at-home child with my wife, who and he is excelling in everything, and he's 5 years old. He's already reading at practically a second grade level, which is great, which is to be expected in that circumstances. Now, when you take a parent who is maybe a single parent or who does not have a high school education, barely knows how to hold a job or even balance a checkbook, and just happens to get pregnant. I mean, yes, accidents happen, and sometimes these people do it on purpose. But, you know, our philosophy here is, do we make that child, do we punish that child for the circumstances in which they were born in? And studies, and we have numerous studies that show that child, if they're put into a Head Start program, if that Head Start program is properly administered, because there are specific guidelines that make that one program better than others, and I can tell you we are under the microscope when it comes to regulators to making sure that we are on target with everything we have to do. I don't agree with all of them, but these kids do receive a benefit from this, and it's better than nothing, and which is what they would get if they were left home alone. And could these parents can't afford to put their kids into a traditional daycare, so they're stuck either getting welfare or being able to put these kids in these programs, so now they can go to school or they can get a job and they can start pulling themselves out of poverty and not be restricted to feeding off the welfare system.
And let's also not forget that programs like Head Start, like you're describing, Bill G, are created primarily because of a system that forces everyone into cubbyholes. And one of the main cubbyholes that everybody gets forced into is the public education system. That public education system, despite all the efforts of those who advocate public education, really don't provide equal access to everyone, except to the extent that everybody who goes to public schools these days is basically being brainwashed into the ways of the state and brainwashed into but playing the role of monkeys, if you will, to feed the egos of the politicians who like to do very fancy measuring to show that their schools are so much better than they were 10 years ago when in fact they're not. And Head Start becomes basically an adjunct to that. But as you pointed out, Bill G, in reality, it doesn't do anything, well, it may not do anything to overcome the adverse effects of public education. At least it does seem to have a little bit better productivity than public education. That public education is actually declining substantially in this country and has been for quite some time. So I guess it depends, Bill Westmiller, on what you compare it to. And that's what I noticed about these studies that say the Head Start doesn't get anywhere. They don't, what do they compare it to? They don't actually compare it to what actually happens when you get into public education. They compare it to, they compare students coming in with or without to public education. But what happens after they get in there? Well, you know, it's a downhill spiral anyway. So I think that argument's kind of moot.
Well, the studies I read are academic studies. They're not partisan studies, and they're not advocacy studies. And basically, they take thousands of kids in Head Start, and they compare them with thousands of cohorts with the same economic and social circumstances, and they track what the benefits or consequences are of the Head Start program. And after 2 years, like second grade, there's no distinction whatsoever.
Right, because they're being put into a second grade system that's basically destroying them educationally anyway. So again,
that's actually a fault of the public education system.
I agree.
Because the Head Start system is separate from the public education system. Once these kids go into the public education system, I mean, having had worked in the public education system myself, I can tell you firsthand that it is not just broken, it is irreparably broken. So, you know, you take these kids that are school ready. They know their ABCs. They know how to interact in a social environment. And then you put them in a public school system where they're mixed in with their peers who have not had the benefit of a pre-education, and they end up conforming to the lowest common denominator, which is what kids are apt to do. and put into a large population, especially when you've got 30 kids to one teacher in a first grade classroom. And study after study shows that that model just doesn't work under any circumstances. And so these impoverished kids, they may have a leg up when they come in, but by the time they reach the second grade, they're right back in the regular population. So there's probably some merit to that study.
Yeah, I was in a fortunate enough circumstance being employed to be able to send my kids to preschool, and I sent them, all three of my daughters, to Montessori schools, which is a preschool system that libertarians enjoy. But I wanted to clarify a point that a lot of libertarians think that, or a lot of people think the libertarians are opposed to charity. We're not at all. And I'm totally in favor of helping people that need help, that are doing the best they can to cope with the situation and circumstances they're in. And so libertarians have no objection whatsoever to helping out people that are deserving of help. The distinction is that the government just helps everybody based upon various static criteria. It isn't that they take any account for the circumstances or whether or not these people are worthy of charity, which would happen in a private charitable organization doing the same work as the Head Start does.
That is, you have a point there, and because I've seen it from both sides, and there's absolutely, you do have a point there.
Bill G, I'm going to also ask you, in your role as an economist, because listeners will remember that Bill is quite a skilled and I would say respectable economist. And so in that role, wearing that hat, what do you think of the current situation, both with the government shutdown and the pending debt crisis? Is this catastrophic city, as President Obama would like us to believe? Is this something that is just holding the line, like the Republican Tea Partiers would like us to believe? What's your take on it?
It's a tough call, because there's a lot of doom and gloom of economists out there that are saying that once we breach that debt limit ceiling, and then it's going to be Armageddon in the bond market. And I agree, it would be Armageddon in the bond market. But what's very fascinating about this is you listen to the pundits on Fox News and whatever, and they're talking about the government shutdown. I'm like, it ain't affecting me, because, well, yeah, the country club's still open. So, yeah, I guess it isn't affecting you very much. But now we're talking debt ceiling here. Oh my gosh, my portfolio may lose value. That's something we should be really concerned about. And even this this fight with the debt ceiling, the bill is going to be putting through is only going to extend it for a month. I mean, it's not like it's going to be a huge, ginormous deal here. It only gives them a little bit of breathing room, and the government's still going to be shut down. They're not even talking about reopening the government right now. So it's more smoke and mirrors here.
I believe actually they're talking about opening it for 6 weeks, which seems kind of funny, really.
No. They're actually not talking about opening. Everything I've read said they're not talking about opening the government. All they're doing is they're allowing the debt ceiling. They're raising the debt ceiling for 6 weeks.
Well, that's true. You're right. They haven't specifically talked about reopening the government. I thought that it was implicit in that, but you're right. They didn't specifically say that.
That's what people at work were saying when they were reading the article, and I read it, and I was like, no, they're not talking about opening the government. They're talking about raising the debt ceiling, so that way all their Wall Street people aren't going to be jumping off of the new World Trade Center.
Yeah, people get confused because, I mean, how many people really follow closely what goes on in government funding? And it's two separate issues. The budget resolution that they're considering is totally separate from the debt ceiling. It's a very peculiar way that Congress does its work. First they pass a bill saying, let's do this. Then later on they say, we need money to do that. Let's pass a bill to appropriate some money. We don't have any money, so we have to borrow some. So let's pass another bill to authorize more debt. So it's a three-step process, and people can get very confused about one step over another. For example, passing Obamacare, it included all kinds of things that cost money. but there had to be a separate appropriation every year for the money that's being spent. And if they didn't have the money, there has to be a separate bill to increase the debt. So it's confusing to people that aren't as wonkish as I've been over many years.
Well,
and they get confused.
It's also confusing, apparently, to Wall Street. I mean, I don't know if you saw the New York Times. There was an article by Nathaniel Popper, who writes about investment banking there in their deal book section. And his article is entitled, Government Standoff Shakes Trust in U.S. Debt. Just to read a couple paragraphs from it, he says, in good times and bad, the world's financial system has long been able to rely on one thing, that the United States government would pay back its debt on time. Well, I'll question that one in a moment. This assumption has made short-term government debt the most basic building block of the financial system, as reliable as a dollar bill. In recent days, however, the fiscal impasse in Congress has been testing investors' confidence, and as a result, investors have been shifting their money out of the $1.7 trillion market for the short-term government debt known as Treasury bills, worried for the moment at least they may not be the risk-free asset that they have known. Indeed, it now costs more for the United States to borrow money for a month than it does for the average highly rated American company to do so. And he goes on and on about that thing. Well, first of all, I want to point out, I hope that what he's saying isn't true. I don't think it is that the people on Wall Street really believe that the United States government will pay back its debt on time. Because if they really do believe that, then they're even more clueless than I thought they were. But I honestly don't think that they believe that.
No,
here's
the key. The key is that when people talk about debt, they mean two different things, at least in regards to government debt. With government debt, there is the debt that has already accrued that is part of the total debt of the United States that has increased every time there's a deficit. And the way that they finance that is selling treasury bonds. So the cost of maintaining the treasury bonds that they have as debt is like 6% of the budget. They have to pay interest on those bonds. They have to get some bonds back and issue some new bonds to replace them and so on and so forth. That really isn't in jeopardy. It's 6% of the budget. They can cover that kind of debt anytime they want to. But people use the same word, debt, with reference to every obligation the U.S. government has entered into. So, for example, if you've got a defense contract for 31 new bombers or whatever it is, you've got that contract, and that's a debt, an obligation that the federal government owes to the contractor. Well, they might not be able to pay the continuing expense of covering that debt, or it might be Head Start. You know, the ability to cover the outstanding obligations is also referred to as the debt. But the debt ceiling specifically refers to the treasury bonds, the authorization to issue more treasury bonds than they currently have and increase the total amount of money owed by the federal government. And it's confusing when people talk about that because it makes perfect sense that if Congress has already passed a legislation to do something, that they're going to pay for it. And they're saying, no, we're not going to pay for it. Therefore, you can't do it. Without actually repealing, for example, Obamacare, they're just going to defund it so there's no money to run it. So it's a very confusing use of the word debt by both sides in this rhetorical war.
Well, another tactic that they've been using is they've been allowing they've been putting themselves on these arbitrary deadlines, and then they don't meet the deadline, and then they end up with a sequester, like we had this last year. And the sequester did all that budget cutting for them. It did a 5% cut right across the board of every federal program out there. And even Head Start had to have a 5.2% cut in its administration funds and in its grant funds, and that resulted in over 50,000 children who were served by Head Start in the previous year no longer being served this year. That's a nationwide figure, and the agency that that I was working for, I'm still working for. They lost two. They had to close two centers, and they had to lay off 12 teachers, and and we ended up losing a great deal of money in our operating funds because we also received money for our operating funds.
Yeah, but the word cut doesn't really mean cut in government.
That's true.
Like a
yeah.
babble. I mean, it's, for example, the sequester supposedly is 5% across the board. It isn't across the board because it just affects certain programs. But the actual amount is not a reduction. It's a reduction in the anticipated growth. So even though the individual programs aren't getting as much as they would expect they would get or plan to get or budgeted to get, affects the number of people they're able to serve, the actual cut in government expenditures was less than 1%. So it's not really
that's
a cut.
That's true for some. That's true for some, but I can tell you that from where I was sitting, it was a true cut.
Mm.
Because what was cut was the grant itself. The grant was cut. So
if the
grant was cut and we don't have other sources of income to make up that 5% cut, it is a real cut for us.
Yeah, every department was given discretion as to how they allocate the cuts. For example, if you cut across the board on Health and Human Services 1%, they can lump all of that, 10% cut here, 10% cut there, 0% cut here, and so on and so forth. So they prioritize within their own departments in terms of the sequester. But I think talking about all of these, mechanics of who gets what money, where, when, and why, I think we're overlooking the overarching issue, which is that most people in the United States are sick and tired of having their baby born with $40,000 worth of debt on their backs. And they're disgusted with the way that politicians spend money that they don't have. So there's that running against the effects that it has on people who become dependent. It's true.
And I would agree with Walt, is that it is primarily the fault of the monetary system. And we've created a monetary system that necessitates this kind of program to exist in the first place. And I agree, too, that you fix the monetary system, this problem will fix itself.
Well,
getting back to the article in the New York Times from just a moment, Nathaniel Popper, and tying into what Bill Westmiller was just talking about a couple minutes ago about there being two different kinds of debt here and that it kind of confuses the issue. I was hoping maybe you could specifically address this one particular sentence that was in the article. Let me read it to you again. It says, investors have been shifting their money out of the $1.7 trillion market for the short-term government debt known as Treasury bills, worried for the moment at least that they may not be the risk-free asset they have known. I think I know what your answer is going to be, is are they really risk-free assets?
Well, you're asking me?
Bill G., actually.
Okay, well, are they risk-free assets? Well, there's no such thing. In investing, there's no such thing as a risk-free asset. Because there's always a risk that, you're still borrowing on the full faith and credit of the United States, and if that is ever in question, then no, it's not it's not risk-free, which is why the interest.
And I think this is really at the core of this whole monetary expansion discussion that is kind of the umbrella of what we're talking about here, because I think that Popper actually does touch on a meme, if you will, that continues to play both on Wall Street and in the halls of power in Washington and so on and so forth, which is that the full faith and credit of the United States is the basis of a risk-free investment, if you will, or an asset, and that because it's risk-free, that enables us to continue to expand the money supply endlessly. So it just struck me when I read that this is a very good description of a very bad philosophical idea. I thought it was just really nicely laid out in the New York Times just how crazy the idea is, even though he didn't intend that.
And also when you think about what is risk-free debt when it comes to Treasury bonds, if a Treasury bond is only paying less than 1%, you're actually losing money on that investment just by buying it. So you buy a government bond, you lose money on it for the duration that you own it because inflation outstrips whatever you actually going to earn in interest on it. So it's not risk-free. You are actually losing money on this. So that's that is a loss.
Well, we're halfway through the show. Let's take a break, and then after the break, Bill's going to come in and give us another take on this whole bonds issue. Plus, we're also going to take a look at some of the other issues that are kind of swirling around the news, including the fact that we have a new Fed chairman nominee and the latest allegations about the NSA and what the NSA's ability to defeat encryption are really all about. Is it true that they can defeat all kinds of encryption? And a little bit of news about Edward Snowden as well. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walt Thiessen and Bill Westmiller, and special co-host today, Bill G, joining us after, I guess you might call it an extended vacation that will continue after the show.
Was that a paid vacation?
But before the break, we were talking about the Nathaniel Popper article in the New York Times, and we ran out of time for the first segment before Bill Westmiller could put in his 2 cents. So, Bill, what are your 2 cents about the Treasury bonds?
Well, I just remember that Treasury bonds used to be rated AAA up until the time when the sequester went into effect. And a lot of people say, well, the bonds were downgraded by, I don't remember if it was Moody's or S&P, from AAA to AAB. And a lot of people say, well, that's because of the sequester. No, it was because the sequester wasn't as large as the bond companies thought was necessary to maintain the standing of the U.S. Treasury bonds. And so there were a lot of pension funds that had hysterics because their provisions and the bylaws required buying AAA bonds, and they couldn't find any AAA bonds anymore. So, but what they're afraid of is not that the bonds are going to have, that the government's going to have any problem paying for the bonds, paying the interest and issuing them, because the Fed's buying half of them anyway. But the concern is that if the debt increases significantly or the government stops or delays payments to military industrial contractors, the farm program, or whatever it is, if they start cutting back on those have a direct effect on the economy and a direct effect on the profits of the military industrial complex. And so they're not so much concerned about the bonds as they are about the possibility that the payments that have been budgeted are not going to be made to the businesses that are running the government in almost every aspect as corporate partners. So that's what could have an effect on the stock market.
I'm thinking about that meaning of that term, corporate partner. There's all kinds of ways we could go with that, but this is a clean show, so we'll keep it that way. Other news that came out this week that's kind of related to all this, particularly where monetary policy is concerned, is that Janet Yellen, the current assistant chairman of the Federal Reserve, is going to be President Obama's nominee to succeed Ben Bernanke when Bernanke's term expires. And I love the article that you found, Bill Westmiller, from the L.A. Times. The headline was, Yellen is Bernanke with lipstick.
No, that's my headline.
What's your headline? Oh, that's okay. Well, then I like your headline. Your headline's great.
Yeah, but, you've heard the old saying of a pig with lipstick is still a pig. So I was taking off on that old saying. But it's Yellen is an insider. She's a good friend of Bernanke. She's been the vice chair of the Fed for the past, I don't know how many years. She's not going to change any policies on anything. People are just suspicious because the Fed has so much discretion. They can do anything they damn well please. And Yellen has kind of implied that she prefers using the Fed to reduce unemployment, even if it causes inflation. And so they're concerned that the amount of quantitative easing is not going to be tapered off, but it's actually going to taper up, and that they're going to have more and more quantitative easing under Yellen than they did under Bernanke. I think the Fed is going to be wishy-washy no matter who's running it. They're trying to satisfy politicians and the Treasury and everybody else, the bankers as well. And so they're in a bind, and there's no way out, really. It's a hopeless situation. So who runs the tragedy, it doesn't really matter much to me.
Well, given the fact that I misread the headline, maybe this snippet that I see next to it, I'm getting this one wrong, too, but hopefully it actually does come from the LA Times article.
Yes, it
but,
does.
I found the snippet interesting. It says, for now, Fed critics have been largely quieted because inflation is very low and shows few signs of rapidly increasing in the foreseeable future. And I just wanted to comment on that one because the only reason it's low is because they've changed the metrics so much that it's impossible for it to be high.
We wouldn't know
if there was inflation by their measure.
Yeah, and I mean, the Congress basically has given the Fed the authority they have and given them two tasks. One is to keep inflation low and to keep employment high. Well, their efforts to keep employment high are pretty much a disaster. They haven't gone below, what is it now, 7.4% or something like that, in spite of, you know, tens of hundreds of billions of dollars put in to stimulate the economy. Well, Yellen says, you know, we need to do more. We need to be more aggressive in terms of increasing employment. And that means more, you know, manufacture of fiat currency. And that's what people are afraid of, is that we're going to get into a runaway inflation situation. So it'll be interesting when they have the hearings on Yellen's appointment in the Senate to see what she actually says. I'm sure she's as mealy-mouthed as Bernanke is, and nobody's going to be able to guess what she's going to do, if anything.
Which means she'll probably be confirmed.
We're already in a runaway inflation situation. We're just not seeing it because it's all ending up on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. The thing that I keep looking at, and it just keeps getting my attention over and over again, is we supposedly have, 1 to 2, maybe 3% inflation, and yet when you look at the exact same numbers measured the same way that they used to be measured back in 1980, they come up to 9 to 10%. So the thought that goes to my mind is, if we were to take the same method of measuring that is used today to measure inflation and applied it in 1979, 1980, when we had stagflation and the beginnings of very high inflation rates, I wonder if those very high inflation rates would have come out to 2 to 3%. Which means we wouldn't have measured it there either.
Well, the odd thing from my perspective is that they even think that any inflation is beneficial to the economy. You're distorting the money supply, and whether you do it by 1% or 2% or 10%, it's still distorting everybody's economic perspective on what assets they have and what their money is going to be worth a year from now. So it's built into the whole economic system that you have to have inflation or you can't have growth. Inflation is fake growth. It's a bubble. It's meaningless. It has no economic value to anyone. But they think that that is what they need to do to increase employment. It's crazy.
So what do you think, Bill G? Is the continued monetary expansion going to make your employment situation better?
Well, monetary expansion, no, it does not make it better because, I had to take a pay cut to take this job for my previous job. And then on top of that, we don't get raises at this job because our funding keeps getting cut. And then on top of that, the monetary expansion makes those dollars that we do have worth less and less. So we're actually getting even more pay cuts as we go along. So, no, it's funny that over two-thirds of our employees at our agency are actually eligible for
Obamacare.
The very programs that we administer.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin to comment on that, except to say, I mean, doesn't that make it like a conflict of interest?
Well, these are people. These are not, you know, these are not just people off the street. These are teachers with degrees. We've got people with master's degrees. We've got some very smart people working for us, but we're all being paid 30-40% below the going rate, because we work for a nonprofit, and apparently that's supposed to be rewarded in of itself.
We had a story last week talking about the percentage increase in real income, pointing out that like 80% of the population has had a decrease in real net income over the past 10 years. And the primary place where there has been an increase in net income for individuals is in the Washington, D.C. area, where the income have increased like 50 or 60% over the past 10 years. So all the bureaucrats and politicians and lobbyists and so on in Washington, D.C. are making out like gangbusters, but everybody else in the population, and they're slowly beginning to realize it, are getting screwed by all this quantitative easing, inflation, deterioration of the money supply, and the effects that are bound to come.
I wonder, too, how much of the population is being undercounted in terms of the negative impact that all this is having on people. I mean, Bill G., I was kind of making light of it, but the fact that so many people are having to work in your agency there far below what they're used to making is just one symptom out of a much larger set of symptoms. I don't know how to measure it. I have never seen comprehensive measurements, but I have to believe that it's probably at least half the population, maybe more, that is suffering substantially in their economic situations compared to, say, 5-6 years ago. And a large percentage of that are probably living pretty much hand-to-mouth. And yet there doesn't seem to be any measurements about that anywhere. It's like we talked about this before. They don't really have good economic measurements for this. But
there is a measurement. There's a very good measurement. It's the number of people enrolled in food stamp programs. That number has exploded since 2008, and it continues to rise.
Okay, that's certainly an indicator.
Partially because the bubble, housing bubble, exploded, but I forget what I was going to say.
but even that doesn't. I'm sure it doesn't capture the entire population that is severely adversely affected, because there are a lot of people who don't go on food stamps through pride, through whatever else, just because they're continuing to struggle to make ends meet. You know, they'll work 2, 3, 4 jobs. They don't qualify for the food stamps, but for all intents and purposes, they're suffering just as badly as the people who are on food stamps. So yes, I agree it's an indicator that something's going on, but I'm not sure it really measures the full panoply of the problem.
There's another measure of how many people are moving into multifamily households. That number's on the rise as well. And the reason why people go into multifamily households is because they can't make it on their own with their income, or they lost their house due to foreclosure. And, you know, I point to myself in this because I'm in that exact same situation. I'm now living in a multifamily household with family members because I can't get a house.
Yeah, I think the key is that the overwhelming majority of the population doesn't realize the effects that accumulate when they're getting screwed very slowly, 1% a year. And that's hard for people to measure day to day or even year to year. It's looking back, you know, 2 years ago, what was I able to buy with a dollar that I can't buy anymore? And they just don't. Most people don't understand what inflation is, and they blame it on the corporations raising prices and making food more expensive and making everything else more expensive.
Can you blame them? I mean, the inflation rate is reported at 2-3%, even though it's very likely much higher than that. Of course they're not going to understand. I mean, how could they possibly understand when the information's wrong?
That's what governments and politicians do best. They lie.
and also, when you look at your... If you're going to look at your gross income, you're going to look at your W-2 to see how much you're making from year to year. You may be seeing an increase throughout from the last 10 years, but then when you look at what you're spending that money on, if you did not see a 5 to 10% increase in your pay from year to year to year, what you're going to see in your spending habits is that you've been cutting back and cutting back, and it's been maybe slow at first, but... You know, eventually you look and you're like, well, you know, why don't we go to Disneyland anymore? Why don't we go to, you know, why don't we do a vacation anymore? Well, there's no money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bill, there's an article that we've been carrying over for a couple of weeks now, and it's capturing my attention in the context of this discussion because of the headline that you wrote about. You said U.S. debt highest since World War II. I know I'm kind of taking this out of our normal flow here, but I'm curious to know what that means because, I mean, U.S. debt is in terms of its nominal amount, the actual number, is far exceeds anything that happened in World War II. So what did you have in mind with that particular headline?
I'll have to find the article, but there's a confusion because when they talk about U.S. debt, it doesn't necessarily mean federal government debt. It includes federal government debt, state debt, local debt, and personal debt. And so the amount of debt in the U.S. economy is not multiples, but exponential, hundreds of times greater than it was 10 years ago. Because people have had to borrow money to compensate for the loss of income. Let me see if I can find that particular article.
Well, that's all right. You know, go ahead and find it if you can. But it just caught my attention because even if we add all those different kinds of debt, both government and non-government debt together, I mean, 20 years ago, the numbers far exceed anything in World War II. It's got to be some sort of a percentage thing that particular headline was about. So I was just curious about that. We've been spending a lot of time on both the shutdown and monetary. There are a couple of things that have been going on that I want to spend a couple minutes on. First of all, didn't get a whole lot of coverage, although ABC News did touch on it. There was a meeting that took place between four Americans who are ex-members of the NSA, CIA, FBI community. Who were whistleblowers, they met with Snowden in Russian to give him an award. This is an award that was granted, what was the date of this thing? Just within the last few days, they flew to Moscow, and the award, where is the award? I'm not finding the name of it. But it was issued by, it was presented by four former whistleblowers who themselves were basically trodden upon by the U.S. government in response to their whistleblowing efforts, many of whom were trying to make the same kind of whistleblowing arguments that Edward Snowden made. Names were Thomas Drake, where's the rest of them here? Raymond McGovern, Jesselyn Raddick, and Colleen Rowley. They met with him secretly. They did not provide any details about where he is or where he's living or anything other than to say that he is trying to include himself in Russian society. I mean, in theory, he is under a temporary amnesty, a temporary protection by the Russian government. But in fact, he's kind of settling into society and learning how to speak the language. Apparently, he even has a Russian girlfriend. So he's settling in nicely over there. But the whole purpose of their going over there was to reward him, to basically give an award for doing what they themselves had also tried to do, and that was to bring some very serious breaches of public trust to public notice, and certainly Snowden has done that with distinction. The thing that I found particularly fascinating about it is that all these people formerly worked for the Secret Security Services of the United States, and in that context, they present a very different view of Snowden's activities and revelations than what we typically get from the people who head up those organizations. Bill G., I'm going to bring you in on this. I presume you've been following the NSA story to some degree and what's been going on with Edward Snowden. Do you what's your take on Snowden? Do you think he's a traitor? Do you think he's a patriot? Do you think he's just a person who did his job? What do you think about him?
Well, I think he should have probably planned his whistleblowing a little better instead of being stuck at an airport in Moscow. I think he should have probably lined up a country that would be willing to give him asylum and then do his whistleblowing. I mean, I definitely don't think he's a traitor. I mean, I think he was just simply stating some of the very disgusting things that the NSA is doing, breaching every trust that we ever had or ever thought we had in the in our own government. And basically we're right back to the Red Scare. We're right back to the worst days of J. Edgar Hoover and McCarthyism, as far as people and journalists and people who work within the federal government being afraid to say anything that goes against either the party line or go against their supervisors at the NSA. It's rather scary what's going on over there, and Snowden's revelations just barely touched the surface, I think.
Yeah, well, that's still, much we do know.
Yeah, there's still more to come, according to Glenn Greenwald. They haven't even done a quarter of the documents that Snowden revealed. But I don't think Snowden could have planned it in advance. See, I mean, he knew what the NSA was tapping and what they had access to. He didn't even tell his girlfriend. He didn't even tell his family when he headed out for Hong Kong. But he didn't do it as expeditiously as possible, but I'm glad it came out the way it did.
Yeah.
I think all libertarians consider him a hero, and I think you can add on to that, people that consider him a superhero are all the people who have leaked the corruption and the invasive programs in the past. And there are a lot of people that are giving him a claim. In fact, I doubt the establishment in Sweden will allow it, but there are some people who have suggested they get a Nobel Peace Prize, which I think would be beautiful.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the Nobel Committee is dominated by U.S. foreign policy. So
Yeah. Well, we could always hold out hope against hope. I mean, you never know.
Well, you know, if ever the Nobel Committee ever became truly independent, maybe it would. Maybe give it to
you. Maybe they could take back Obama's Peace Prize for having continued the Afghanistan war and give it to Snowden.
Oh, absolutely.
That would be a used prize, though. Would you really want a used prize?
I don't know. Maybe you would. At this point, maybe you just take anything you can get from them. But, okay, one other thing to touch on about the NSA, and we only have about 2 minutes left anyway, Bill, there was a piece that talked about how the NSA can't defeat all forms of encryption. TOR, TOR encryption, is something that they have not been able to defeat, and it makes me wonder, is this something that the major computing corporations, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Microsofts of the world, are going to latch onto as they build their own encryption routines to now try to counter what the NSA has been doing? Do you have any information about that?
Unfortunately, I have way more than 2 minutes of information, but let me see if I can condense it down. The program is called TOR, T-O-R, which stands for the Onion Router, and it's not really an encryption, although it incorporates encryption. What it does is it messes up the Internet packets so you can't trace it. Now, this is a program that was actually developed by the U.S. Navy so the U.S. government agencies could communicate with dissidents and so on around the world and wouldn't have to worry about governments butting in. So now they're trying to break the TOR code under programs like the Onion Breath and Quantum Cookie and all this kind of weird stuff so that they can actually intercept the messages that are being used by dissidents against them. So it's an interesting exercise. They're trying to defeat their own program, and TOR was used by Silk Road, so they closed down Silk Road. It's used by Bitcoin vendors, so they're trying to shut down Bitcoin. So it's rather humorous that their own program is defeating them so far in terms of keeping communications confidential.
And with that, we're at the end. But Bill G., thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm more than happy to do it.
And Bill Westmiller, we'll see you all next week, too. And I hope all of you listeners come in, too, because we'll see you next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Crying to those themselves, the armies of salvation.